This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. It's now 7:36. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Julian Ng and Sherrod Kutin here with me. And we're going to take a look at the business headlines now from now till 8 o'clock. Let's start with some macroeconomic news in Indonesia. Indonesia's budget deficit has narrowed in 2016 as major spending cuts helped offset less than expected revenue from a tax amnesty program. So the budget deficit for Indonesia's economy was estimated at about 2.46% of GDP. That's slightly down from 2.58% in 2015.
So the finance minister for Indonesia is Sri Mulyani Indrawati, who was appointed from the World Bank, actually. So a technocrat rather than a career politician. And when she was appointed to the role, her first priority was to fix the budget, which she thought was not credible. And she has so far managed to do that in the latest budget, reducing the budget to deficit ratio of around 2.5%.
Melissa, you mentioned the less than expected revenue from the tax amnesty program. I thought the tax amnesty program was well received and was thought of as a success.
Well, it was well received, but I think the targets were quite lofty, to be honest, Sherrod. The government set really high targets, and whether or not they achieved it, I think, is still kind of up for debate. Whether that was, shall we say, a successful program is still up for debate.
I think a lot of the analysts that we spoke to about the issue of tax amnesty and the degree of funds going back into Indonesia, these analysts considered that the tax amnesty was a roaring success, actually, because they compared that to tax amnesty programs of other countries, and the rate of collection compared to the targets, even though they were quite small, as you pointed out, Melissa, they were the highest in the world, among the highest collection rate in the world compared to other countries. So it is kind of a success and gave a little boost to the government budget.
Well, speaking about the Indonesian economy, there was news that the Indonesian government had terminated all business partnerships with JP Morgan Chase because JP Morgan had downgraded the Indonesian equity market by two notches. It went from overweight to underweight following Donald Trump's election win. Now, the finance ministry in Indonesia says, well, we're not going to use JP Morgan as a primary dealer and as an underwriter of the sovereign bonds anymore.
Exactly. And there are also a lot of tax payments by Indonesian companies which were previously routed through JP Morgan, and now they will be passed via other banks. This is according to Bank Indonesia government Agus Martowardoyo. And I think at the heart of the issue here is the independence of banks' opinions when giving investment advice to clients. Banks are in a special position of having two types of clients, one on the buy side, which are investors, and the other on the sell side, who are clients who, for example, who are issuing paper like shares and bonds like the Indonesian government. So offending either side will result in the loss of business. And in this case, the Indonesian government was very upset and they cut their business to JP Morgan.
So what do you think about the move? Do you agree with it? Because, you know, it is the Indonesian government's prerogative to pick whichever bank they want to do business with. Clearly, they're showing their disapproval following the move, but you feel like there should be a certain element of independence or distance away?
I think that should be an arm's length position that's being taken here, because after all, JP Morgan did not recommend something that was so damaging to the reputation of Indonesia. What they in fact recommended was that there was a tactical, what they call a tactical response to the Trump election win. So nothing to do with what Indonesia is doing, but really all about what Trump is doing in the United States. So I think the Indonesian government should chill out a little bit and not get so uptight about what JP Morgan is saying. I also think that this is at the heart of the lawsuits, you know, the subject of lawsuits just after the subprime crisis, where many analysts' recommendations were glaringly wrong or compromised. So here we are calling for a more independent approach to stock or bond recommendations or even economic recommendations. And then we have here a government that is frowning upon such independence.
I will come back to the question of the Indonesian budget. You know, the big story last year was infrastructural spending. spending. And in fact, it was funny because the president was sometimes criticized for his overemphasis on infrastructure to the detriment perhaps of things like education stuff. But do we have any sense of the payoff from that massive building effort that's going on in Indonesia? You know, roads, ports, and this is an archipelago of thousands of islands. I mean, what has it done for the economy, apart from the companies directly involved in creating that infrastructure?
Well, I think that it's clear Indonesia has insane infrastructural congestion. So the payoffs will not be in the form of monetary profits, but in the form of the ease of such congestions. And I think that will take a few years to play out. I mean, we're talking about billions upon billions of infrastructural spending here. But even so, if you look at what they spend on their budget deficit, is about to the extent of 2.5% to their GDP. And this compares to around 2% a few years ago. So the Indonesian government has certainly expanded the deficit to GDP, but this is still not as high as what Malaysia is spending. We are spending about around the 3.2% level right now, around the 3% in the latest budget. And this is down from 4.5% for Malaysia. And it has, of course, credit where credit is due. Malaysia is also taking steps to reduce their deficit, our deficit. The question is whether this is right in a time when the challenges to economy is just blowing up.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to Singapore's economy, taking a look at the economy there. Singapore's economy expanded faster than expected, 1.8% on year-on-year basis in the final 3 months of 2016. This is more than the 1.2% growth in the third quarter. And what this means is that Singapore has managed to dodge a technical recession, which is defined as two straight quarters of declines in economic output.
That's right. The contraction for the July to September quarter was 1.9%. We're talking about quarter-to-quarter contraction here. And if the December quarter experienced a negative Q-on-Q contraction again, that would be classified as a technical recession, and Singapore avoided that.
Julian, do we know the reasons for the growth, even if it's not that dramatic?
Yeah, there were some improvements in the manufacturing and services sector, and this helped to underpin the growth in the final quarter. And the manufacturing sector actually makes up one-fifth of the Singapore economy. That sector expanded by 6.5% on a year-on-year basis, which was way higher than the 1.7% growth in the previous quarter.
Well, you know, it's still, even though it's some good news there, but this is also Singapore's weakest annual rate of growth since 2009. The economy then was hit by the global financial crisis and shrank 0.6%. Last year, Singapore's economy grew 2%, so it's still not as good. I have to say that going forward, it could be quite tough for Singapore, simply because it's such an open economy, and now that Trump is, the uncertainties of a Trump presidency, I think could weigh on Singapore.
That's right. Your views are also echoed by Nomura economist Brian Tan, who says that the headwinds coming out of the United States, Europe, China, basically the whole world is weighing down on Singapore. There are also a lot of the source of government curbs in the property sector in Singapore that has pushed the property sector and the construction sector over there in Singapore downwards.
Yeah, is that a good thing? Because Singapore home prices fell 3% last year. That's the third straight year of declines. If you look at it on a kind of a quarter basis, it was the 13th straight month, longest streak since the data was first published back in 75. You want homes to be cheap for Singaporeans, but all in all, is that a good thing that prices are so low?
Yeah, I think we got to divorce government policy here from the interests of these property developers or contractors to make profits. And I think that the degree of curbs that were introduced over the last 2 years, including a government cap on debt repayment costs at 60% of a borrower's monthly income. Right. So you can only borrow up to 60% of your income, which is pretty high, actually. Also, the low interest rate and demand from foreign buyers raised concern that prices had risen too fast at that point in time. I think these are all part of the arsenal of government policy to allow the local citizens to participate in the housing sector. We see that they have very strong policy measures in HDB. These are very long-term policy. So I don't know when they would move in again back into the property sector to focus there and ease some of the curbs that have been in place for the last 2 years.
Yeah, I think there's too much fear about overheating the property market. But yet in Australia, we see that Australian house values have increased at the fastest pace in 7 years. And of course, this was because the very low interest rate policy in Australia.
That's right. 8 to 10% rises on average, but there's some unevenness. If you look at mining towns like Perth, is Perth a town or a city? Perth doing quite poorly. There are also concerns of overheating and oversupply right now.
Okay, 7:46. We'll take a look at local business news after this, where we discuss the new levy on foreign workers. Details next on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.